Accession number 31785, reel 2.
So stories about lucky escapes, or the fact is that, you know, a lot of the German bombers were duds, apparently. So story of somebody's uncle who lived in the bottom, in the basement flat, and the bomb hit the top and went right through and came to rest on the bottom of his bed, and it didn't explode. So he just kind of hangs his clothes on it now, you know, and so on. All kind of, but the kind of last minute rumors. Camus describes it very well in the, I think in the plague. Camus, yes, the plague. Anyway, it's kind of, that's by and by. Take it out. But that was very kind of memorable, and then one day we saw them, you know, kind of classical film stuff. There were Germans in on motorcycles with a sidecar, going along the edge of the forest, and they kind of glanced at us and passed on. So we kind of got the horses hitched up and started going back, and met some German soldiers with an officer who asked for papers, and undoubtedly the Swiss passport of my aunt's kind of helped us to be waved on. But also everybody in the party spoke German, because everybody in the party had been citizens of the German Empire before the 1914 war. So, you know, so we went back, and the thing which, again, were the kind of endless dead horses everywhere. Also the soldiers' graves, you know, very fresh, of course. And the ones with the Polish helmets, usually you had the helmet stuck on top of the cross. There were flowers there already. And somehow the local villagers were, you know, coming and putting flowers down, and that was very moving.
This was still the first few weeks after the invasion.
Yeah, so that was coming back, I guess. I think soon after we started going back, we woke up and there was silence. So the fighting must have ceased, more or less. I mean, we must have been around the, I think it was around the 17th, 18th, you know. So, yes, it's, and the dead soldiers, I only saw when we were still, you know, moving eastward, and they were bringing them in on wagons full of hay. You don't have to have hay for dead bodies, but it seemed to me that it was a kind of, I don't know, some kind of a gesture that, you know, you put soldiers' bodies on something soft, the kind of last thing you can do for them. They're not there really anymore, but somehow, and they're kind of half covered by the hay. Yeah. And we went back. We went back to the Vituskis and waited. And that was extraordinary days, because at the back of the Vituskis were the Austrian regiment with on their belt buckles "Gott mit uns," and, you know, "God with us." And but at the front of the Vituskis house, the door was open most of the time, and there would be people knocking, and there would be these strange males, always men, dressed up in very kind of odd outfits, saying, "Second lieutenant of the Poznan cavalry, could I stay the night? I'm trying to get home." And there was a big round table on the right hand side of the in the entrance hall, with vodka and glasses and some kind of sausage or something and bread. And they would kind of, and Maria, the Tuska, would say, oh, just help yourself. And then they would kind of help themselves and disappear. And I was sitting under the table watching this kind of constant procession of Polish officers being trying to get home. And then my father turned up on a bicycle in tails, and with a box of chocolate under his arms, and very angry and furious. And he got the chocolates from a Jewish shopkeeper. He got the tails from a school teacher. The tails belonged to the school teacher's father, so he kind of changed his uniform into that. And the bicycle, I think, he kind of borrowed. And he was very angry because he just was furious the way the general staff handled the war. And apparently he actually, at one point, turned up at the headquarters in Warsaw. He was a second lieutenant, not a very senior rank. And had a terrible row with some staff officer in the Polish headquarters, a totally incompetent idiot and coward and so on. So he wasn't kind of defeated; he was just very, very angry. And then we went back with him and my uncle. I think I can't remember. It must have been all of us. Oh, I don't know. My uncle might have gone ahead. Anyway, we got back, and we arrived at night in our old home, and we hadn't really kind of got inside the home. Someone became running and saying that the Germans were arresting and shooting all the returning Polish officers. So my father just turned around, got on the horse that we were using, and kissed us and disappeared, to turn up later on in Sweden and England and so on, and we joined him eventually, but that's another story. The place was ransacked and so on, so there wasn't really much fun going home. The Germans were clearing out all the Poles out of that part because it was going to be incorporated into the Third Reich. So we left very soon after that, really, for Krakow. And that was the end of September.
Were you much aware of what people's expectations as to the British and French response was?
They were dreams. The dreams were, I mean, the French were much more important to the Poles than the English, because the connection with the French it was very strong, and the French had a kind of messianic role because of Napoleon's creation of the Duchy of Warsaw, in 1810 or 9 or whatever it was, earlier, 7, 6. There was this feeling that the great French army would kind of move, but the whole campaign seemed one of it was carried out in a state of absolute shock, partly because there was expectation that it might be tough, but we would be all right somehow, that we would be able to, with swift movement of troops, Polish weather, mud everywhere, maybe with a bit of luck in September. It turned out to be the sunniest September ever. Lots of rivers everywhere which could be defended. Just the experience of having beaten 20 years earlier the Russians and disarmed the Germans. I mean, the reality of all that, this kind of lucky coincidence in Polish history, moment of kind of miraculous moment. The two powers that always controlled us, or tried to control us, were so weakened. It wasn't kind of appreciated enough, I guess. But the, I grew up in absolute confidence in this extraordinary, enormous Polish nation, because it had these frontiers in the east which were quite ridiculous, because there were not very hardly any Poles living there. But when you look at the map, it was a vast country. So the shock of the defeat, the humiliation, incredible. Because I mean, as a kid, when we were going back home, passing towns and villages where the Polish eagle, which is a kind of the great patriot, you know, the kind of the sign of nationhood, was wrenched away from all the official buildings and thrown in the road and so on. I felt it terrible, the absolute humiliation, the kind of smell of defeat. Well, not to mention the fact that the Russians invaded Poland from the east on the 17th of September. So I felt it was a terrible shock. It was absolutely unexpected. And what happened afterwards with the Germans was unexpected too, especially particularly for people like my family, who my mother's family, who were quite proud of having been German citizens. I mean, they cultured nation, you know. So the whole kind of Hitlerite thing was an enormous shock. Yeah.
Had you any awareness at that stage of the eventual length of the war?
No, not till Paris fell. Fall of Paris. I mean, the people just cried and cried in the streets. And I came out in the streets of Krakow with a child the day Paris fell, and there was just absolute despair, because as people could see that it was going to go on forever.
What happened then when you got to Krakow?
When we got to Krakow, Krakow was a center of the German administration, and my aunt lived there, and we stayed with her. I went to school, and I had a Jewish friend, and after a while he had to wear the Star of David, and then I didn't see him anymore. But our school was moved. The school was taken over by the German army, and we were moved to a new school in the old Jewish quarters. The ghetto had been created, but they had pushed the Jews into a small part of Krakow. And there was a Jewish school kind of made available. And walking there was a grim experience, because people had been thrown out of the houses, you know, with kind of half an hour's notice, and there was this kind of all the things that people drop and leave behind. It was quite awful, really. So it wasn't much fun. Although the winter of 1940 and 41 were very good for skiing, and I learned to ski. But you know, we did our kind of patriotic bit by collecting old 35 millimeter film, packing it into containers, going into the woods around Krakow, and setting fire to these. They produce an enormous amount of smoke. And you may not kind of appreciate it, but if Germans saw enormous amount of smoke in the woods, they would send their troops out to investigate, and therefore waste their energy. Right? So this was our kind of 10, 11-year-old's fight for, against the occupier. Krakow was fairly peaceful compared with Warsaw. It was quite deadly. But it wasn't, there was trams at the beginning for Juden, for Poland, for Germans, separate seats, and then the ones for for the Jews disappearing. Yeah, it's but miraculously we got away. But it's another story.
How much did the German occupation intrude on your day-to-day life, as it were?
Well, you're surrounded by this signs of power, the occupying forces, the soldiers at gates, the soldiers marching, the fact that some shops were open to close, some were not, some were just for Germans, and so on. The kind of excitement of being invited by my aunt, who spoke excellent German, bilingual, to coffee in a for Germans only cafeteria. Madness. But there we are with very nice cakes, and there were some pluses. Like one of my mates at school said, "Look, you know, my father is a caretaker, or was a caretaker of a Polish school, and taken over by the Germans, and all the school library is up in the attic. We just helped ourselves, you know." So I thought, "Well, great, you know." So we went down there, and sure enough, there were all these books, and including Just William. So, and I was just was getting into the Just William books then, and so I remember, you know, swiping about half a dozen Just William books, putting in my rucksack and trotting off home and reading them as I went along, or reading one of them. And arriving home and meeting a furious mother who had booked a train to take me on summer holidays, which I'd forgotten somehow, you know, things happen. And travel by train was very tricky because you had to have not only a ticket, but you had to have permission to go, right? And as a child, you couldn't travel by yourself. You had to go with somebody else, and she had fixed up some relatives to that would accompany them. And so now we went down to the station, and she persuaded a family to make it appear that I was part of the kind of thing. And so we climbed onto the train. It was full of people smuggling things to the countryside and back from the countryside. And I remember we stopped at the station. This mass of people running across the field from the wrong side of the carriages, you know, escaping from the control on their platform. Why the Germans didn't put some people on the other side of it, I do not know. But I just remember them looking out of the window, thinking, what the hell is going on? We've got a platform on this side, but everybody's kind of getting out across the field and legging into the nearest forest. That was my kind of last holiday, I think, one of the last ones. Because that was quite an early June holiday, because somebody came shouting up where I was staying that the Germans had invaded Russia. And some kind of great aunt went up to a secretaire, you know, for letters and so on, and she said, "Hitler will end up the same way as this guy." And she put out the declaration of war by Napoleon that she had kept from, what is it, her family had kept, you know. And she was right. And then I went back, to Krakow, we lived by one of the main streets going from west to east. And there was extraordinary non-stop horse traffic going east. I mean, the German army relied on horse transport and stuff to go east. It was just endless. It was just extraordinary. But you know, children accommodate themselves and adjust, kind of thing. So,
how did people regard the segregation of the Jewish population, the increasing? persecution.
Krakow. I can really kind of put it in my family terms. When my father's family came from Warsaw, and I wasn't really kind of involved with them very much. I was surrounded by my mother's family. My mother's family, like I said before, had been citizens of the German state and knew exactly what the rules of that state was, how you lived in it, you know, how you operate, how things were done and so on, right? And one of the biggest kind of shocks of my mother's life was when the Germans dispossessed her. I mean, just inconceivable for the Germans to do that, in the kind of pre-1914 period. You know, the rule of the law was absolutely sacrosanct. And so the Jewish situation was it's incomprehensible to people in my mother's family. I think it took a long time for people to kind of get to grips with it. And my aunt, my mother's sister, ran a children's home in Warsaw, and she has an olive tree growing on the side of a hill in Jerusalem. Because she was instrumental in saving so many Jewish children's lives and so on. My father's friends, painters and so on, one Nacht Szamborski, he and his paintings and my father's paintings will be exhibited next year in Warsaw together. Quite moving, really. I mean, my father's kind of artists and intellectuals, all the rest kind of. I mean, they reacted, of course, with horror, and then they, in most cases, tried to do their very best to help. When we did leave Poland. In 1941, we left our Polish documentation, with the family of the little boy that I played with, and they survived the war on the strength, partly, of that documentation. Kind of found it out many years ago. So, but the general population. I can't really say. You know, the complexity of the Jewish-Polish relationships, and it's not something that I would want to discuss now. I mean, I can happily discuss it. I mean, the only thing I can say is that what happens now, what is happening now in Poland, which gives me enormous kind of pride, really, that in the last few years, Polish historians and Polish public really are much more ready to face the truth about that relationship, and work on it, like the Germans, the West Germans have done with Hitler. You know, and I think once you start working on these things, then you can move on.
How much were you aware of what was happening in the other theatres of war? As the Germans were advancing
throughout Europe? We all, as proper little boys, we all had maps with pins stuck to them and so on. Yes, people, of course, we were very aware of every single thing. Yes, absolutely. I mean, the Norwegian campaign, all that kind of stuff. But I mean, we left Poland in must be a kind of October, September 1941. When the Germans captured Smolensk, we were in Berlin on the way to Sweden. Because I remember the announcements of the vast number of prisoners taken around Smolensk. And once we were in Sweden, I spent all my time looking at maps and so on. So, yes. So.
What was it then that finally drove your family to decide to leave Poland?
Luck. Luck and the kind of extraordinary situation which existed in the German Foreign Office. The German Foreign Office hadn't been penetrated really by the Gestapo or by the kind of Nazi, although they had the Ribbentrop as a minister. I think the civil servants working there were the same civil servants who worked there for years. And when a war starts with another country, there's a little book of rules, right? You ask the ambassador that he has, tell the ambassador of the country that you've invaded that she has a week to get himself going, that there'll be a train available, but could they please the Polish government that of the country you've invaded indicate which country would they like to take care of their business while the war is going on, because eventually there'll be peace and so on. And I mean, the kind of vast annexation of territory which Hitler was thinking of was unknown, really. Well, not totally, but it wasn't there to be expected. Kind of, well, it wasn't part of the rules of the game. And so the Polish ambassador left for Sweden. Sweden was appointed the country that would take care of Polish affairs during the war. And at the same time, right in September, there were three Polish submarines in the Baltic who couldn't get out, and they were interned in Sweden. And the crew asked whether their families could join them, since for the duration of the war, they might last a year or so. And the Swedish government asked the Germans whether this would be possible. And the German Foreign Office said, well, just women and children, no reason, no, they're fine, nothing in the rule book against this. And so there was a trickle of Poles going to Sweden, Polish families, women and children. After a while, I think the Germans got a bit nervous about it because they were being interviewed in Swedish press. But it just so happened that one of my father's cousins was the Polish ambassador in Sweden, and he asked the Swedes whether, because my father turned up in Sweden in a kind of long-winded way, but he made it to Sweden. So we were we received entry visas into Sweden, and my mother went to see a guy in Krakow, in the German office, responsible for issuing exit permits, and it turned out to be somebody that her family knew from a long time ago, I think. I'm trying to find out next week when I go to Krakow and talk to the historical German Historical Institute there. And this guy gave her the exit papers, so formal. And my mother went to the Gestapo to get them counted, kind of signed, and so on. And they tore it up. I said, of course not. And everybody said, well, that's it, you're never going to make it now, and my mother said, well, I'll try again. And she got more papers from this guy in the offices, and this time she walked into the German Gestapo headquarters in Krakow, and she was bilingual in German, and she could put on a face that looked like a what I call a German Field Marshal's face from Stalingrad, gaunt. And she just walked in and started shouting in German, I'm waiting here, I'm going to catch a train, can somebody come and get these papers countersigned, right? And, a young Gestapo guy kind of sprang up and said, stamped it. And she said, "Danke schön," and sort your uniform out, and walked out. And we were on the train, I think the next day. We went by train to Berlin, and then...